This is Law and Disorder.
Today on Law and Disorder, the Kings Bay Plowshare 7 defendants face up to 25 years in federal prison for protesting nuclear weapons.
We all know about climate change, but the subject of nuclear destruction is way in the background. These people are helping to bring it forward.
Attorney Bill Goodman returns to Law and Disorder to talk about litigation in the Flint water crisis case.
Here you had the governor and officials on down pumping filthy river water directly into people's homes for them to drink. Sounds to me like a crime against humanity.
Stay with us.
I'm New York City attorney and author Michael Stephen Smith.
And I'm New York City attorney and activist Heidi Boghossian.
In our society, nuclear weapons that can destroy all creation are taken as normal, even an inevitable part of life. In a dramatic action to break what they call the crime of silence, 7 Catholic peace activists entered the Kings Bay Trident submarine base in Georgia last April to perform an act of symbolic disarmament. They used hammers to follow the prophecy of Isaiah, to beat swords into plowshares, and they poured blood to make holy what was evil in a sacramental action. Kings Bay is home port to 6 ballistic missile Trident submarines, each of which deploy 16 Trident missiles carrying 4 or more warheads of at least 100 kilotons. The Hiroshima bomb was 14 kilotons. Each submarine, thus, has the destructive power of at least 500 Hiroshima bombs. The Plowshares 7 face up to 25 years in federal prison. Their trial is coming up. Theirs was the latest of 100 Plowshare actions around the world since 1980. Joining us today in the studio is returning guest Martha Hennessy, a Kings Bay Plowshare 7 co-defendant, an activist, and a volunteer with the New York Catholic Worker. And also with us today is Patrick O'Neill, also a Kings Bay Plowshare 7 co-defendant, an activist, and a member of the Catholic Worker. Patrick, Martha, welcome to Law and Disorder. And Martha, in your case, welcome back to Law and Disorder. It's nice to see you.
Thank you.
With the emphasis on disorder, we're more on that side than the law. Thank you.
Bravo. Martha and Patrick, please tell us in a bit more detail what you did, how you got on the base, and when you were there, what did you do?
We walked onto the base. It was a very large area, 17,000 acres, I believe. We broke into 3 different groups. One group went to the nuclear weapons bunkers. One group went to what we called the missile shrine, where they had mock-ups of all of the different missiles that they've created over the years. And then the third group went to the Strategic Weapons Facility Administrative Building. And we had banners that read, "The ultimate logic of Trident is omnicide." We posted an indictment citing Nuremberg principles, Geneva Convention, U.S. Constitution, condemning and pointing out the illegality of these weapons. We left Daniel Ellsberg's book, The Doomsday Machine, there as well. We strung up crime scene tape, and we spray painted "Love One Another, May Love Disarm Us All, Abolish Nukes Now."
And what time of day was this?
It was at night.
At night.
We came to the base a little bit after sunset.
And were there, I'm just curious, were there staff or personnel in plain sight, or did you sort of sneak by?
The first hour was certainly sneaking around in the dark. There were no people. And then when we made it to the administrative building and the missile shrine, we did see people there, but it took them a very long time to arrest us.
When is the trial starting, Martha?
October 21st, nearly 20 months after the action.
What crime specifically are you charged with?
Yeah, there are 4 charges. 3 of them are felonies. One is conspiracy, which is a 5-year felony. One is destruction of naval property, which is another five-year felony. One is depredation of government property. To depredate means to plunder, to lay to waste, or to prey upon. That's a 10-year felony. And we have a trespass charge which carries 6 months. So the actual maximum sentence is 20 years and 6 months. But I think it's amusing that we're charged with depredating the ultimate depredator.
Yeah, really. And when is the trial starting, Patrick?
It starts in, it's in Brunswick, Georgia, which is just a little bit north of the Florida border in southeast Georgia, in federal court, and it's October 21st at 10 a.m., Monday morning.
What is your legal defense?
Well, the difference in this case, in the Plowshares history, is that we're attempting to use the Religious Freedom Restoration Act, which is law that came into being in 1993 and has actually been used to set some bad law, and we're not sure if we will be stripped of that defense. As it stands now, we haven't yet.
Could you use a necessity defense as well?
Let me establish what the government's criteria is. The system is rigged, always. I mean, 99.8% of people who get arrested by the feds plea bargain because the system's rigged, you're always convicted. It's very rare to get an acquittal unless you're a multimillionaire and you have some way to play the system. But so the government is basically saying, you can't talk about the necessity of what you've done. You can't talk about international law. You can't talk about religious freedom. You can't talk about the compelling aspects of your religious convictions. The only thing you can tell a jury is what you did, not why you did it. And that's why the feds succeed in pretty much sending everybody to prison. So every time Martha, for instance, gets up there and tries to quote Isaiah, swords into plowshares, she'll be immediately objected to. The objection will be sustained. The nice thing is we have seven defendants. Five of us are pro se. So we can stand up one after another, being objected to, sustained. And we're hoping that at least one juror in South Georgia will look at this and say, how come these people can't answer any questions? How come they can't defend themselves? Because they won't be privy to the pretrial motions that have stripped us of our rights. So they're going to be very surprised by what happens.
I'm a little confused about those pretrial motions. How often does that happen where they bar certain defenses?
Well, it happens all the time in plowshare cases because there's a 39-year history of using these defenses. So there are now three or four circuit courts that have precedent opposing international law, opposing necessity. But like Martha said, the Religious Freedom Restoration Act is new ground. There's no precedent against us using it. And in fact, because we chose to use the Religious Freedom Restoration Act, we were permitted some remarkable pretrial hearings in which we called witnesses, a Catholic bishop, a theologian, Jeanine Hill Fletcher from Fordham University, to talk about, one, did we have religious beliefs? The court determined yes. Were our religious beliefs sincerely held? The court determined yes. Was our practice of our religion burdened because of the government's actions? The court determined yes. But they turned everything over and said, no go on the Religious Freedom Restoration Act because of the government's government's compelling interest in protecting its own property. So they said that trumped everything. Now, the argument that they should lose the least restrictive means, which is the fifth element of RFRA, of course they didn't. They gave us three felonies. I said in open court, Judge, the only more restrictive means we could have had was if you shot us. Three felonies, that's what we've got now.
And with the in limine motion from the government, they have already established that. The two things that will not be discussed is the lethality of these weapons and whether the weapons are on that particular base or not.
Yeah, here's a fascinating follow to that. If you trespass under federal law, it's just like Florida. In Florida, trespass is a six-month sentence, but if you do it on a citrus grove, it's a year. The way the feds work is, if you trespass on federal property, it's 6 months. If it's nuclear, if nuclear weapons are present on the property, it's a year. We only got 6 months because the government does not want to confirm that there are nuclear weapons there.
They would like to portray to the jury that what we did was the same as walking into a used car lot.
What about the legality under an international law of the use of nuclear weapons?
you know, Francis Boyle, who was at Illinois Urbana, who is the premier international law expert in the United States, written a lot of books. In fact, he's written books to help pro se defendants use international law in their defense against nuclear weapons. And Boyle is almost never allowed to testify as an expert witness, almost never permitted to, even though he is the premier expert, because the judge is saying this isn't relevant. The only thing that's relevant is, did you cut the lock to get on the base, and did you hammer on something and destroy government property? That's what we're here to decide. We're not here to decide, you know, international law. What's that got to do with it? The federal courts will say that's not in our jurisdiction. We don't care about international. Well, they won't say we don't care about it, but that's what it means. We don't recognize the authority of international law.
And for the last 39 years, the Plowshares movement has tried to introduce into the federal courts expert testimony on the legality of the nuclear weapons, and the U.S. federal courts have managed to obstruct that.
Yes, we've had several shows on that issue, principally that nuclear weapons are so destructive that they shouldn't be allowed under law, that they kill so many people, that this is really beyond the pale. Daniel Ellsberg, in his book, The Doomsday Machine, which you left there at the base, he writes that nuclear war has nearly occurred 20 to 30 times, and these missiles are on hair trigger alert. Is that the reason that you left the book there?
We left the book there because of Daniel's history of being an insider. He was cleared for top security clearances. He's the one who released the Pentagon Papers, but the bigger story for him was the nuclear arsenal. His job was to figure out how to conduct a nuclear war. And I think the biggest reason for us leaving that book on the base was to point out the fact that it took him 6 months in his work to figure out how the chain of command worked and who gets to pull the nuclear trigger. And what he found out was that there are underlings who can do it any time. So we have, on two occasions, Russian soldiers who did not do what they were told to do because they were not sure that they were under attack. So, you know, if you can't believe in God, just believe that, well, somebody sure is making sure we haven't blown ourselves up yet.
You know, Michael, I wanted to mention, you made in your introduction reference to the fact that being on hair trigger alert, where every major city on the planet is 15 minutes away from Armageddon, basically, that has in fact become normal. 73 years after Hiroshima and Nagasaki, most people on planet Earth have grown up under the mushroom cloud. It's just been part of people's lives. They no longer think about it, which is the pride and joy and jubilation of the military-industrial complex. They don't want any critical thinking. If you remember back in the 50s in New York, they would make people go down into air raid shelters. They were warning us about the possibility of an exchange between the Soviet Union and Russia. No more. Don't worry, folks. We're in charge. We got everything under control. In other words, the less the public knows, the more the military-industrial complex can do and get away with. Now here, we show up in Kings Bay, Georgia. There's a little town, St. Mary's, Georgia. Martha and I get the seven of us get a visit from the local priest at the Catholic parish. He serves the crew of the Tridents when they're in port. In his parish, the Catholic crew members go to his church right by the harbor. And he came to see us, and he said, you know, you guys have caused me some problems with my parishioners. They're asking me how a bunch of Catholics can break into this base here, destroy the property there, and claim to be doing it in the name of Jesus. He says, I don't know what to tell them. The good thing was he was ready to listen. So we were able to talk to him, and Father Steve Kelly, the Jesuit priest who's our co-defendant, who has now been sitting in a jail cell in South Georgia for 18 months, as of the 4th, two more days, he'll have been there 18 months sitting in that jail cell. And he spoke the language. He's a theologian. If you might remember, Steve Kelly's the one who did Dan Berrigan's funeral. He was the priest who celebrated Dan Berrigan's funeral here in Manhattan. He spoke the same language as this priest. Well, this priest listened. 30 minutes later, he completely understood us politically and theologically. He got it. But here's the question. How does this priest, seminary trained, sitting and looking out his rectory window, seeing Tridents float by in the harbor, not realize that the entire community's lives, the lives of this community, are predicated on the end of the world. He never thought about it. And that's the problem. No one's thinking about it.
He's also a Polish priest. He comes from Poland, and he was a young man, and he grew up under the threat of invasion. The whole history of Poland was in the back of his mind as well. So he thought that self-defense was critical. And we were able to at least point out to him that this is not simply self-defense. This is offensive work.
I just want to go back to one point that you mentioned, Patrick, because as you were speaking earlier, I was thinking, we don't have those duck and cover drills that we did at the height of the Cold War, or mention of bomb shelters. And that is so interesting because it does, as you say, keep it out of the public's conscience. If we started to have those again, I think it would make more realistic to a lot of Americans how dangerous the threat is right now.
But I think the point is that when you mentioned the destructive capability of the tridents in your introduction, the clear reality of this is there is no duck and cover. The weapons are so over. I mean, if Osama bin Laden had had a nuclear weapon 19 years ago, there would be no Manhattan. He would have used it. 5 million people would have died. So we're talking about something that you can't duck and cover from. It doesn't exist as an option anymore.
And that was the point of the air raid drill protests in 1955 to 61 that Dorothy helped spearhead. There is no survivability.
And Martha, we should mention you are the granddaughter of the great Catholic worker, Dorothy Day. Patrick, could you tell us a bit about your background?
Dorothy Day was a big influence on my life as well. I worked at the War Resisters League. I'm wearing one of their T-shirts here in the studio. And also the Catholic Peace Fellowship in Manhattan back in the late 70s. And so I was fortunate enough to meet Dorothy Day at the Catholic Worker, which, you know, is only a few blocks away from the War Resisters League's former headquarters.
At 339 Lafayette.
At 339 Lafayette, right. The Peace Pentagon, the New York Times called it.
Yes.
But anyway, my background was similar. I grew up during the Vietnam War, but you know, my mother was a widow. My father died in a construction accident here in Manhattan, working on the Westinghouse building in 1960. So my mother was left a widow with two young preschool boys. She was only 23 years old. The war starts, and my mother has already experienced death. And she was worried as the years went by that my brother and I would reach draft age. And she always told my brother and I, if this war's going on, when you kids are old enough to be drafted, we're going to Canada. She wasn't going to, you know, allow her children to be cannon fodder. So I always grew up with a healthy skepticism about U.S. foreign policy and U.S. war making. And then people like Dorothy Day and the Berrigan brothers and our co-defendant Elizabeth McAllister, Phil Berrigan's widow, we were in those circles where people were skeptical about U.S. foreign policy and U.S. domestic policy for that matter. And so I think that's just, you know, I spent that my life sort of under that tutelage or mentorship with people who work for peace and justice. In fact, there was a priest who I lived with in North Carolina I moved to, and he was a friend of Elizabeth and Phil and Dan. And he came to visit me in prison one time. I've had three other federal prison sentences, and he came to visit me. And I introduced him to the guards and inmates as the man who's responsible for where I am today.
Patrick and Martha, do you get criticized for a strategy that inevitably results in arrests and prison time? And what would be your answer to that?
Yes. I certainly hear from family members, you know, why did you do this? What is the effect of it? How do you think you're going to change things this way? And I remember Dorothy's words, we're fools for Christ. I would rather speak up and stand somewhere and critique the status quo than not. I have to say that, you know, it took a lifetime to prepare for this moment, to be able to take this kind of action. And our voices are being heard far and wide despite the mainstream media blackout. And it's a witness that I feel called to do. And we are to sow seeds, and we may not see the harvest. And I have 8 grandchildren, and I'm very happy to go on record saying no to this insanity.
That's a beautiful thing to say.
And I have 8 children, 6 girls and 2 boys, and all of my children and my wife support me completely. So that's a comfort. I am pretty thin-skinned. I do have other relatives like Martha does who basically trust the government. I think that's the greatest weakness in this country. Anybody who's grown up through McCarthyism, Watergate, the internment of the Japanese, the Iran-Contra. I mean, anybody who's read anything and say they trust this government, it's questionable how it's possible, right?
How can people learn more about your case, the Kings Bay Plowshare 7, and how can they support you?
Law and Disorder. Listen, please, everyone.
Well, we have a website, Kings Bay Plowshares 7, the numeral 7. .org. And on that website, we maintain all of the current information about the case and information about how to get to Georgia and where to stay if you want to come to the trial. And also on the website, we have many of our statements that we've had to write during this whole process. So you can certainly learn about our case as well as some of the other cases in the history of the Plowshares movement.
If people were slow in getting a pencil, could you please repeat that website?
Kings Bay Plowshares 7, the numeral 7.org.
Why did you choose to act on April 4, 2018? What is the significance of that date?
Well, it was 2018, it was the 50th anniversary of the killing of Martin Luther King Jr. I believe it was a state killing. And we try to carry with us his words regarding the triplets of militarism, materialism, and racism. And we base one of our banners on, his quote, the ultimate logic of racism is genocide. The ultimate logic of Trident is omnicide. And, we are seven white privileged people. I do have a bit of nervousness about this co-opting of Martin Luther King Jr., but the whole pivot of this case and of 500 years of white domination, everything pivots on the nuclear arsenal. It is the keystone or the capstone that makes the rest of the system work, which is, the triplets that Dr. King spoke of.
I was going to ask you if Trump has opened the door to a new nuclear arms race, but I think the question is really broader than that, particularly it looks like Trump may have one foot on a banana peel. But in any case, has our government opened up the door to a new nuclear arms race? After all, it backed out of the nuclear treaty with Russia, and they want to build new nuclear weapons systems. A new submarine are coming out at a cost of $5 billion apiece. Can you comment on that, please?
It's very, very frightening times is really the way to look at it. The bottom line is that people who make money off these weapons have no vested interest in peace. They have a vested interest in their own incomes, their own earning capability, and that translates into having a vested interest in tension, creating tension. So one week it's Venezuela, the next week it's Iran, you name it, Syria. It always keeps changing, but one thing remains the same. There's always some enemy we have to be prepared for, but no enemy that could ever match us in firepower. It's a tactic that's designed to draw us in deeper. I mentioned in court at one of our hearings to the judge, I said, Judge, our charges should be dismissed because the United States is no longer a democracy. When the three branches of government march in lockstep in support of militarism and war making, then the only dissent that you have is from people like us. We're the only people that are making the democracy have some semblance of function, right? That we're dissenting. I said, so we're performing a service. Remember that last year, Donald Trump's $800 billion war budget passed the Senate 93-7. So where's the disunity? Where's the disharmony between Democrats and Republicans when 93 senators vote yes to war? War that's endless, right? You're in New York. Since 9/11, it's been endless war.
It's been endless war since my birthday in 1942.
Exactly. Thank you.
Are you getting support from the next generation?
my children.
I think that the climate change is certainly foremost in the minds of young folks. And I do see a dynamic occurring where climate disruption and militarism are beginning to be linked together. I mean, the U.S. military has the largest carbon footprint and is consuming, you know, inordinate amounts of oil to maintain our stranglehold around the globe. And I do think that young people have been raised to not think about it. I mean, we no longer refer to it at all, and our trial will be a classic example of how we're not allowed to even process the realities of what we're doing. So I do think that young people are very capable of standing up and speaking out about their futures.
We're coming to an end of our allotted time, unfortunately, but let me just ask you a broader question. Paul Magno has written that, quote, "If humans lose our capacity to act selflessly and sacrificiously on behalf of future generations, we ultimately capitulate to death forces of our own creation, materially and spiritually." What are your thoughts on that?
Paul was a co-defendant of mine in a Plowshare action back in 1984 in Florida, so we got three-year prison sentences together back then in the mid-'80s. Other than the fact that he roots for the Boston Red Sox, we agree on everything. I'm from the Bronx originally. But
I couldn't tell.
Paul, you know, Paul is, you know, a theology graduate of Georgetown, a sharp mind, and sees things acutely, clearly. He's the treasurer of our support committee, and I think that quote speaks for itself, Michael. I think it's absolutely true. We have to be paying attention. We have to approach the world with our eyes wide open, and with a healthy degree of skepticism, especially today.
Martha, your thoughts?
Well, the nuclear weapons, to me, represent the compulsive insanity of humanity trying to dominate. You know, it's all a logical result of what we have been practicing for the last 500 years.
Martha and Patrick, we applaud your integrity and your persistence on this life and death matter, and we will be thinking of you in Georgia in a few weeks.
What day is the trial again?
It starts October 21st. It will likely last for at least a week. Now, here's one thing you might want to know if you want us to come back and talk about the trial. There is a good chance that after assuming we're going to be convicted, I don't like to be too pessimistic, but that's what I think is going to happen. The judge can allow us to stay out of jail pending a pre-sentence investigation, which can last for a couple of months. So it's possible that she will not remand us to custody right after the trial if we're found guilty. So if we're not found, you know, if we are found guilty, or if we're not, we'd be happy to come back in November and December to talk more, because I don't think we'll be sentenced till January.
Well, we are totally in support of what you're doing. You're always welcome on Law and Disorder.
What kind of leeway does the judge have in sentencing should you be found guilty?
The judge is the goddess, the god.
She can do whatever she likes.
The pope of her courtroom.
No mandatory minimums.
Well, no. What it is there are guidelines which, you know, the defense and the U.S. attorney kind of go back and forth on it. They settle on guidelines, or the judge settles on the guidelines.
Right.
Generally, her reputation, Judge Lisa Wood, is to sentence at the middle of the guidelines. But take into consideration this. Martha and I have been wearing these leg irons, this leg monitor. If you calculate the amount of time that we've actually been confined to our houses since we were arrested, Martha and I have already served 9 months of 24-hour days in our houses. We get no credit for that.
Oh, no credit.
No credit whatsoever.
We will be following the trial and reporting to our listeners and wishing you all the best on this moral journey.
We are so grateful. Thank you.
Thank you,
Patrick. Thank you, Martha.
Thank you.
Visit us online at lawanddisorder.org for archived programs and links to many of the issues we discuss. That's lawanddisorder.org.
The Notorious
notorious Flint, Michigan poison drinking water case has been in litigation for more than 3 years. Detroit constitutional attorney Bill Goodman joins us to give an update on the case. Former Michigan Governor Rick Snyder, high-ranking former members of his staff, and other state employees are the target of a federal civil rights lawsuit over the city of Flint's water crisis. The lawsuit, which also targets the city, alleges that the officials tried to balance the city's budget through a pattern of devious and race-based activity that targeted the people of Flint. It claims that these public officials lied to the people of Flint by continuing to mail water bills to Flint residents, which they allege fraudulently misrepresents that the city is providing safe, clean water to its residents. A group of Flint residents filed the lawsuit on behalf of all the citizens of Flint, seeking financial compensation for injuring virtually every adult and child in that beleaguered city, for lead poisoning and brain damage to the children, for severe skin ailments and hair loss for everyone, for death from Legionnaire disease, and countless other injuries. In addition, there had been tremendous psychological injury to the entire population. Beyond that, people in this community have sustained massive property damage, loss of business, and financial losses, in addition to compensation, they demand lifetime future medical care. The case asserts that this disaster was caused when a multitude of public officials decided to change the source of water from clean, safe water to dangerous, untreated water, knowing at all times of the danger, and yet lying to the public and claiming that their water was safe when they knew that it was dangerous and poisoned. We will also speak with Bill Goodman about his lawsuit against a private prison corporation for negligence in allowing a gang execution in one of its private prisons. Attorney Goodman is counsel to the inmates at the Wayne County, Michigan jail in the oldest jail condition case in the United States going back to 1971. Detroit is in Wayne County. Attorney Bill Goodman is the former legal director at the Center for Constitutional Rights and a past president of the National Lawyers Guild. He is the attorney for a number of victims of water poisoning in Flint, Michigan.
Bill Goodman, welcome back to Law and Disorder.
Well, thank you.
3 years ago, the water in Flint, Michigan was poisonous, and terrible harm was caused to those who drank it. How did the water get contaminated in the first place?
Actually, it was more than 3 years ago, Heidi. It was 5 years ago. It was over 5 years ago. It was April 24th, I believe, 2014, that the switch was made. And here's what happened. The city of Flint decided that it was going to change its source of water so that it could join a new water authority. And the new water authority wasn't ready to go. There was something called the KWA, the Karagandhi Water Authority. That's what Flint was planning on joining. So in order to do that, they needed a water treatment plant. In order to get a water treatment plant, they decided to re-energize the Flint water treatment plant. And in order to do that, they decided to tap into the Flint River, a highly polluted source. And instead of treating the water from the Flint River before it started to go into the homes of the people of Flint, they just let loose, let this really terrible garbage water go in to people's homes, showers, faucets, and all the rest of it, and they, in so doing, poisoned an entire population. That's how it happened.
Now, when you say an entire population, roughly what kind of numbers are we talking about?
The population of Flint at that time was around 100,000. You know, 100,000 people. Everybody drinks water. Everybody bathes. Everybody showers. Everybody washes their hands. All of these people were, to one extent or another, either immediately affected or eventually affected by this.
What were their injuries?
Depends. Lots and lots of people developed terrible skin rashes. Lots and lots of people lost hair, lots of hair. Lots of people developed various kinds of illnesses, basically from bacteria that were let loose. stomach problems, digestive problems, some flu-like diseases. Some people died of Legionnaires' disease because a bacteria known as Legionella was let loose by this switch. And powerfully, children, especially young children, who absorbed considerable amounts, high levels of lead in the water, developmentally damaged, some brain damaged, and some looking forward to in future life developmental and brain damages. Women who were pregnant in particular, children who were born thereafter, suffered from these problems immediately and some eventually. So those are a few of the problems.
Bill, talk about the federal lawsuit against former Michigan Governor Rick Snyder and the others. What did that lawsuit allege?
It alleged that that Governor Snyder, State Treasurer Dillon, various high-level employees within the Michigan Department of Environmental Quality and the Michigan Department of Health and Human Services, the people who ran the city of Flint, these were sort of local dictators known as emergency managers who were imposed on the people of Flint by the governor. Well, first of all, they made the decision to switch the water from Lake Huron, clean water being piped in from the Detroit Water and Sewerage System, to switch to the Flint River, which they knew was dangerous, knew was polluted, and knew would cause these problems. And they were warned of this, and nonetheless went ahead and made that decision. Once the water then was released, people started seeing that it was brown, the water was brown, that it stunk, that it tasted foul, and started complaining about it. The same public officials, in order to cover this up, told them, don't worry about a thing, there's nothing to worry about, relax, this is all great, water's perfectly fine. So that's among other things, that's what they did. They first of all made a decision they knew deliberately would cause damage to people, and then they lied about it after they did that to the people. For example, even when General Motors cut off the water from the Flint River because it was damaging the vehicles that they were producing in the GM plant in Flint, the public officials continued to pump it into people's homes.
Bill, before we ask you what former Governor Snyder said in their defense, can you remind listeners about the demographics of Flint?
Flint is a predominantly African-American community, although not overwhelmingly. It's approximately, I would say, 60% African-American, 40%, well, maybe 10% Latino, 40% or 30% Caucasian, something like that. And in this regard, Flint differs from all of the surrounding communities in Genesee County, which are virtually all white, not totally white, but virtually all white. Suburbs of Flint like Grand Blanc, Swartz Creek, a number of other such communities, which did not have to deal with the same switch in water that the city of Flint had to deal with. It was only the people of Flint. It was only a community that was predominantly African-American that had to live with the consequences of this terrible decision.
Did former Governor Snyder and others say in their defense?
Oh, they say we didn't know. We had no way to know. We thought we were doing the right thing. We thought the EPA said that what we were doing was okay, which is a problem in terms of how the EPA operated. And we were conforming with what's called the lead and copper rule. The samples we were taking were within the lead and copper rule. So we did everything right, is what they're saying. Now, how they justify not putting in anti-corrosives into the water that they were pumping into people's homes, I have yet to hear a coherent explanation for that. And it's the anti-corrosives that keep the lead out of the water and keep the bacteria, such as Legionella, out of the water. Without those anti-corrosives, those agents are released into the water and are terribly dangerous and poisonous, really.
So do most other water systems have anti-corrosives as a matter of practice?
Absolutely. Detroit, the water that the Flint was getting from the Detroit Water and Sewerage Department, was treated with anti-corrosives, and it was going through these piping systems and not releasing lead or copper or the bacteria into people's homes. But once the other water started to be pumped in, it was loosening and mixing those agents into people's water. So, yes, everyone knows you need to put anti-corrosives in. Their plan was to put it in 6 months after they started pumping the water, which was, in my humble judgment, an insane plan.
Yeah, really, the horse was out of the barn. Why has this suit taken 3 years?
The decision was made in April 2014. Our lawsuit was started in 2015, so it's taken 4 years anyway, and we haven't even really started into what's called discovery. We haven't been able to take a deposition or ask a question of anyone yet. Why has it taken so long? It's massive. There are hundreds of lawyers involved, hundreds of different claims of one sort or another. There have been constant appeals to the Sixth Circuit Court of Appeals in Cincinnati. Now there's an appeal in waiting in the United States Supreme Court for action from the United States Supreme Court. There are appeals within the state of Michigan to the Court of Appeals to the Michigan Supreme Court. So it's an endless smothering of this litigation with paper. The defendants, the state of Michigan, the Attorney General's office, Snyder, all of them have hired, well, there's the Attorney General's office, which is defending a lot of this, but also they've hired tons of major law firms who are, you know, just overwhelming everybody with one motion after another, one appeal after another, and inevitably it's taken a long, long time.
Bill, is this a class action?
The team that I'm a part of represents a group that purports to be a class, but the judge has not yet ruled on a motion for class certification, so it is not adjudged yet to be a class action, but we are asserting that it is. We claim that it is and should be a class action. It's the only sane way to approach this kind of massive litigation.
So where is all of this headed?
Where's it headed? Justice? one would hope that the state of Michigan and the private contractors who are a part of it would step up to the plate here and try to come up with a sane, sensible settlement of this matter. And that's where it should be headed. But if it's not, it's, you know, there'll be trials, one trial after another, one appeal after another. It will be a strain at best on the legal system, and probably it'll be a huge burden for decades if we have to go through all the litigation that we're looking forward to here.
Bill, I'm sorry, can you remind us, what is it asking for specifically in terms of relief?
Well, we're asking for a number of things. We're asking for people to be compensated for the damage that they've sustained. And everybody in Flint has sustained damage, whether it's been physical damage or psychological damage. No one feels safe even today drinking water coming out of their taps. Everyone is still buying and bathing in even bottled water, which is, you know, it's a huge psychological burden that people have suffered. Small restaurants all have been gone out of business. This has been crushing for sort of the life, blood, and vitality of this community, which has been damaged enough by the ailments of the automobile industry. Flint is an auto town. And suffering plenty, and now this really kicked it in the teeth. So compensation, that's first and foremost. They're looking for a guarantee that everybody who went through this process will receive a lifetime of medical care, of treatment, of diagnosis, of all of these kinds of things, especially the children. They're looking to have all of the pipes that were damaged by this untreated water going through it, sort of tearing up the lead and the bacteria within these old piping systems, have all of that removed and replaced by new piping systems, hopefully much more plastic than metal. Those are a few of the things that they're looking for.
Okay, Bill, you've been busy with many lawsuits, including one against a private prison corporation, to switch gears here for a minute. Who are you representing, and what are they alleging happened?
Well, if you take a look at the last issue of the New York Times for the year of 2018, you know how they always, the magazine always does prominent deaths of the year?
Yes.
Our client, a man named Merlin Thomas, is listed in that. He was President Obama's almost his last commutation of sentence. He was a young man who was in prison for many years on a basically relatively minor drug charge in Saginaw. And so he was released from the Federal Bureau of Prisons into a incarcerative setting known as a halfway house, owned by a private corporation known as Bantam Incorporated. While there, that was located in a high crime area on the north side of Saginaw. DeMarlin had been connected with the south side of Saginaw and certain gangs on the south side. Apparently someone, and they have not yet apprehended the person, found out that he was in there because the place was run very poorly and sloppily and dangerously. The doors were unlocked, let's put it that way, at 10 o'clock at night, and two gunmen wearing masks walked in. They knew exactly where he was located because they'd been in touch with either employees of the Bantam Corporation or other inmates. They knew exactly what bunk he was in. They walked in, shot him 17 times, executed him while he was lying in bed. That took less than half a minute. They were in the place for less than a minute, and they walked out, and this is all on video camera. And this is a corporation that has contracts with the Federal Bureau of Prison all over the country involving millions of dollars, and this is the way they run their operation. They're in a high-crime area. They have people who have potentially dangerous backgrounds, or certainly backgrounds that are likely to endanger them, and they keep the doors open. I mean, it's absurd. So that's one. That's our case, yes.
And just to clarify, you may have said this, he was in a halfway house that was run by that corporation.
That's right. It's a privatized system, essentially, yes.
We're speaking with Attorney Bill Goodman, who has a practice of constitutional law in Detroit, Michigan. Bill, what stage is the lawsuit that you've brought against this private prison corporation at?
At the stage of completing what's called discovery, that is depositions, and then it'll be scheduled for trial, and we'll go to trial in the case. That's where it is.
And Bill, what's the name of the corporation?
Bantam Inc., B-A-N-N-U-M.
And do they have a record of other lawsuits against them?
There are other lawsuits. It's difficult to sue this kind of corporation unless you know exactly what you're doing, and many people have tried to sue them by suing the federal government or suing them as federal agents, and that has not worked out well. Well, we are suing them as private parties.
If there's anybody in this country that knows what he's doing, it's you, Bill Goodman.
Well,
Bill, what do they say in their own defense?
They say the Federal Bureau of Prisons never told us we had to lock the door. That's what they're saying.
Boy.
But, I mean, if anyone who lives in an apartment building would feel comfortable in a building where the door was left unlocked all night long, more power to them, I suppose.
Well, let's switch the subject a bit and talk about the Wayne County Jail. Wayne County, of course, is the county where Detroit is located, and there were some terrible conditions in that jail that go on all the way back into 1970, and you've brought a lawsuit against them, which is still cooking. Can you tell us about that?
You're right. This is a lawsuit. If anyone remembers Bleak House by Charles Dickens, this is my Jarndyce versus Jarndyce. It goes on for decades and generations. We started the lawsuit in 1971, Ashley, January of 1971. Many of the people connected with the initial filing of that case passed away, including several of the judges at that time. The conditions at that time were horrible. There was a single jail in Wayne County. It's now called Division II. It's still open. Broken pipes all over the place. sewage running on the floors. People triple and quadruple bunked in cells meant at best for two people. So people were sleeping on mattresses on the floors of these little cells. Conditions were awful. Medical conditions were awful. Brutality was rampant. Over the years, the cases continued with court monitoring, and there's still many issues that have not yet been finally resolved, because incarcerating too many people, there are now three jails in Wayne County, by the way, not just one, but incarcerating people in overcrowded and difficult conditions and understaffed, that's another big problem now because the budgets are so pared down. There's not enough staff to really work the prisons properly, or the jails, I should say, and so there are a lot of conditions. There's still medical issues. There's still other issues involving bunking, involving overcrowding, certainly involving the food, all of these kinds of things. So we continue on with this litigation after, it's getting close to 50 years, I guess, isn't it?
Bill, I just was reading that a little over a year ago, 59-year-old Martha Stanley was arrested, but less than 24 hours later found dead in her Wayne County jail cell. And I just want to read something. A lawsuit was filed, and, quote, Martha Stanley was so physically weak from the aberrant conditions that she was subjected to at the Wayne County Jail, specifically no air conditioning in the building despite extreme heat, 85 degrees, lack of medical treatment, no access to food or water, that she became unable to walk. And they say that the two on-duty deputies taunted her as she begged for help. Don't expect me to give you any bleep, expletive deleted sympathy, they told her. That's horrendous.
Horrendous, I agree. I mean, these kinds of, you know, I'm sure that there would, they would say, no, that's not what happened, but that is a lot of validity to that, let's put it that way.
Yeah.
Well, Bill, you've been litigating these sort of cases for a half a century, and these are particularly dire times for democracy and the rule of law. What advice would you give law students and young lawyers about practicing law in these times?
The question you're raising is an absolutely valid question. What can lawyers and law students, but lawyers and the legal system, do to confront what's going on, which is the challenge of fascism? How do we go about raising this and confronting it through the legal system? There are ways. I think there are things that could be done. I think that the standing doctrine, that is that you have to show that you have a stake in raising the issue you're raising, should be challenged around the issue of we all have a stake in maintaining democracy in this country. Therefore, anyone can sue Trump over the fact that he's profiting off of the presidency, even though, you know, you can't show direct economic loss or injury from it. The doctrine of standing should be relaxed. Now, I don't think the courts are going to do that, but it'll force them at least to address the issue of whether or not democracy is in danger right now. We have to be alert to raising consciousness around what a dangerous and dire situation we all face today. There are a number of ways in which this could be done. The five members of Congress who Trump wanted to send back where they came from, which in the case of Rashida Tlaib from Detroit would have been back to Detroit, I guess. Those kinds of statements about those women have resulted in constant threats of violence against those women. I think that's a conspiracy that violates the 13th Amendment. And can and should be sued directly for it. But these are the kinds of things that at least people should be thinking about. My humble judgment.
Bill, we're running out of time. We could really spend hours talking to you, but we want to say how much of an inspiration you are.
Well, that's kind of you. Thank you, Heidi.
How can listeners keep up with your work, Bill Goodman?
My own law firm has a website, but I'm afraid it's a little, we're so busy we haven't had time to really keep it up to date. But the Flint Water Crisis has a very good website. I think it's flintwatercrisis.com. You can at least keep up with the Flint case that way. You know, send me an email. I'll respond.
What's the name of your law firm?
Goodman, Hurwitz, and James.
Bill Goodman, it's a real pleasure and honor to talk with you this morning. We'll get you back on for a further update, and I hope it's not too long in the future.
Okay. Well, thanks a lot.
Thanks,
Good
Bill.
Good to talk to both of you.
Take care.
Yeah, you take it
bye
easy.
Now. Bye-bye.
Bye-bye.
If you have any comments or questions about this segment or any others, please visit us at lawanddisorder.org. That's lawanddisorder.org. One word, lawanddisorder.org.